From the Kremlin in Moscow, NBC News presents A Conversation with Mikhail S. Gorbachev. Here with the leader of the Soviet Union, NBC News correspondent Tom Brokaw.
General Secretary Gorbachev was already in place when I arrived for our interview in the cabinet room of the Council of Ministers in the Kremlin. We had agreed to talk for an hour. NBC News had informed the General Secretary of areas of interest, but the interview was spontaneous and unrehearsed.
I just wanted to say a couple words about your people and our people.
Right. I had hoped that we could do that at the end, but after all, I'm a guest of the General Secretary.
Ну, я, честно говоря, надеялся, что, может быть, вот именно такого рода обращение последует в конце, но в конце концов, я же гость генерального секретаря. Well, let that be the only hope that is not justified.
Mr. General Secretary, your trip to the United States is widely anticipated. As General Secretary, do you have a better feel for Americans now than you did when you were serving another post in this country?
Знаете,
well, you know,
господин Брокаў,
Mr. Brokaw,
вопрос,
I'll respond to that question.
Но,
but
мне хотелось бы
I would like,
в начале нашей беседы,
first of all, right at the outset,
воспользоваться этим
to
случаем,
avail myself of this favorable opportunity through NBC.
И
And first of all, to say a few words of sincere greetings to all the television viewers who are watching and listening to us, and to all the American people. I would like to address them with words of sincere greetings from the Soviet people. Before responding directly to your question, let me say that this year already I have received about 80,000 letters from Americans. And that is a third of all the foreign mail that has been coming into the Central Committee of the Party. The letters cover a broad range of issues. There are letters from congressmen, from the business people. There's been a lot of letters from coming in from scientists and scholars, from people working in the field of culture, and very many from young people. And you know, and a lot in those letters has stirred me. And you know, many of the thoughts of those letters are similar. They revolve around several simple and yet very important questions and problems, which obviously are of concern to the American people. Now, in those letters, I read about what, that they're worried about the situation in the world, that there's a lot of tension, a lot of alarm, that regional conflicts are still ablaze, unabated. There's a lot of concern, and that, I guess, is, takes first place, a lot of concern about the state of Soviet-American relations. And I felt in those letters, and through those letters, an immense desire of the American people, a very strong desire to change the situation in the world for the better, and of course, pride of place is taken by the need for a change in relations between us, between our peoples. And these letters have given me a great deal and have helped me a great deal to help to understand the American people better. And this sort of certainly adds to the immense political information I receive through other channels, through my contacts with American political figures at all levels. And of course, I do now have a better understanding, as I feel, of American society than I did before I took up this job. But you know what the important thing is, and I'd like to tell you this.
То, что говорят американцы
what the Americans say in their letters addressed to me and to the government of the Soviet Union, to our people, all this is very close to heart and very easily understood by all of us, by Soviet people. And I see in this the emergence of a new situation, and one which makes it possible, perhaps even makes it incumbent upon the politicians and the governments of our two vast nations to try and understand better the mood of our peoples and to give expression to the will of our peoples in our actions, in our policies. At this time, I shall leave aside for the moment other questions, but let me just say that let me just now address myself to the topic of our relationship. I shall be going to Washington with a desire to discuss this problem as well, and I think it's a leading problem. How can we change relations between our peoples for the better? The Americans say now, why can't we be allies? Why can't we were allies at one time? Why can't we be allies now? There's so many problems in the world. Can we join our efforts? Can we join, pool the enormous might of our countries, economic, intellectual capacities, to resolve all these problems? And that is very important. Very important indeed. We need mutual understanding. And I believe that we must display greater respect for each other. Try and understand the history of our nations better. The Soviet Union is a unique phenomenon. It's a whole conglomeration of over 100 nations and nationalities. And just try and imagine that behind us, behind every one of those peoples and nationalities which now make up the Soviet Union, and next year we shall be marking the millennium of Christianity in Russia. But even before that, the Kievan Rus existed with a dynamically developing people, an original culture, and wide ties with European nations. Or take the peoples of the Transcaucasia, of Central Asia. Their history goes way back into the depths of history. A unique history, an original history, belongs to the peoples of the Baltic region, but all these nations now make up the Soviet Union. There's a lot in our history that was not simple. There was a lot of struggle. We had to fight back many invasions, starting from Genghis Khan and Bati and others, in order to stand up for our independence. And you know, that led to a forging of a national character, and our values were thus formed. All of these peoples value their language, their culture, they are patriots. They have a feeling of dignity. And without all of that, you cannot understand us or our actions if you don't know that history. We are dedicated to peace. And that you can travel far and wide throughout the Soviet Union, anywhere, and everywhere you will see and hear a testimony of that. And that's why I say that my visit next week we regard as a very important phase in our relations. It will be our third meeting with President Reagan. And we will be signing a treaty on medium-range and shorter-range missiles. We must address ourselves to strategic offensive arms. We will be discussing other world problems. So, on the whole, we will have a lot of things to talk about.
And we have a lot to talk about during the course of this hour, Mr. General Secretary. Can we begin with some of those now? For example, there is anticipation about your visit to the United States, and I think that there is general excitement about the signing of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Treaty. But there is apprehension on the part of a lot of people that it will leave the Soviets in a superior position in Europe. Are you prepared now to reduce the number of men, tanks, and attack helicopters that you have in Europe?
Well, firstly, the Americans and the Europeans and the others should know that the Soviet Union has no intention whatsoever of attacking anybody. That's number one. Second, there are realities which have taken shape within the framework of the two opposing military blocs. There is a certain asymmetry, both in forces and armaments. We're prepared to address ourselves to that without delay. We have made our proposals, and we are awaiting a more active position, a more active response from NATO. And therefore, we are prepared to deal in practical terms. We are ready to sit down at the negotiating table and tackle these problems in practice.
But I think that NATO and the United States especially would be encouraged if you unilaterally would rearrange your forces into a more defensive position rather than in an offensive position.
We have made known the content of our military doctrine. It is a defensive one. And let me repeat, we are ready to sit down at the negotiating table. And just as we dealt with the medium-range and shorter-range missiles to tackle the question of conventional forces and conventional arms, we will be acting in a constructive way.
What are the chances, do you think, that by next summer that you and President Reagan can sign a treaty to reduce by half, 50%, the long-range nuclear missiles, the really dangerous missiles?
Well, I believe that in this matter, which really does make up, constitute the very core of Soviet-American relations, there are real prospects ahead of us. I believe that it would be hard, perhaps, at this very moment, how our talks will go and what results we will achieve as a result of an exchange of views on this matter during the forthcoming visit in my talks with President Reagan. But in any event, we certainly have a lot to discuss. And I would repeat what I've said previously. We believe that it is possible to do a lot of work with this present administration, still with this administration, so that we could make headway on this major direction in the area of arms control. We will act constructively, and I guess the Americans and the world at large have convinced themselves that we can and that we are indeed acting constructively.
Your chief arms negotiator said the other day that he thought that there could be a 50% reduction in ICBMs and that SDI, Star Wars, would be a matter for the American people to decide. Has SDI, Star Wars, been slightly diminished in your judgment as a condition for the reduction of ICBMs?
I believe that the question of SDI is not a subject for negotiations. We shall be talking about strategic offensive arms, about levels and sublevels, and we have some steps that we could take to meet the American position halfway. We've already taken some. We shall be talking about the strict compliance with the ABM treaty. That's what we're going to talk about.
Am I clear in understanding that you believe that you can reduce ICBMs, the long-range missiles, by 50% next summer, and that you would deal with SDI separately?
We formulate our position in a very clear-cut way. We are prepared to accept a 50% reduction at the first stage with strict observance of the ABM treaty. In that degree that SDI does not run counter to the ABM treaty, let America act, let America indulge in research. Insofar as SDI does not run counter to ABM, that is not a subject for negotiation.
Isn't the easiest way, Mr. General Secretary, to deal with Star Wars or SDI, isn't the easiest way to eliminate the need for SDI is just to eliminate the threat to negotiate a great reduction in these long-range missiles first, and then you wouldn't have the political will or the technical need for something like SDI.
Well, that precisely is what I suggested to President Reagan in Reykjavik. And we were just about two paces away from signing an agreement on that score, but SDI came in and stood between us. If we reduce our medium-range missiles, our shorter-range missiles, and if we agree at the first stage to make 50% cuts in our strategic offensive arms, and then to go on and fully eliminate nuclear weapons, then the question does arise. Why? What is SDI for, and what is the militarization of outer space for? You know, this is an attempt, yet another illusion of the American defense planners through, as they think, through some kind of technological superiority, through the superiority as they see it in computers, somehow through outer space to forge ahead to achieve superiority. But look, tell me, Mr. Brokaw, if you and I were to start trying to count how many attempts there were after the war on both sides to try and forge ahead and to gain superiority, but nothing came of it. We're simply wasting the funds of our people, and we're creating a very acute situation in the world. 95% or so belong to the United States and the Soviet Union. So what are we going to do now? Take weapons out into outer space? That would certainly lead to a destabilization with unforeseeable consequences. Just think it over. How much time it took to find criteria in order to compare the present nuclear capabilities of the sides? This is a very complex question. How to compare them, how to assess those potentials, and yet we found over a decade, decades perhaps, we found a way to do that. But if we go out into outer space with our weapons, if we start having an arms race in space, then what will be the criteria there? There will be a fever. Who wins over whom? And what is more, what if one side sees that it's being overtaken? What happens then? That's my first question. And then secondly, if you lay all your stakes on technology, which simply overrules the possibility of taking timely political decisions, is a very dangerous game. And then, look, if our peoples express that will, why should we orient ourselves on the will or the desires of just one limited group or perhaps one segment in this or that country? That is not democratic, surely. You cannot impose the minority's will on the majority. Democracy is, after all, the rule of the majority.
We just let the record show, however, Mr. General Secretary, that there are a good many people in the United States who believe that the Soviets as well are involved in efforts to militarize space and to develop their own SDI program. And while I don't believe that we can resolve that here today, I think that we ought to move on to new thinking, which is a subject we've been reading a great deal about in the Soviet Union. In your book, Perestroika, you say that new thinking means that security can no longer be assured by military means. What better way to demonstrate that than by getting the Soviet troops out of Afghanistan? Can you tell us tonight when you're prepared to do that?
Well, before I respond to that question, let me just react to your remark that the Soviet Union is engaged in things similar to SDI. Well, it's really hard to say what the Soviet Union is not doing. Practically, the Soviet Union is doing all that the United States is doing. And I guess we are engaged in basic research, which relate to these aspects, which are covered by SDI in the United States. But we will not build an SDI. We will not deploy SDI. And we call upon the United States to act likewise.
If
the Americans fail to heed that call, we will find a response that it'll be 10 or 100 times cheaper. But then the guilt will be, the blame will be lie squarely with the Americans, with the U.S. administration.
But that's the whole point. SDI cannot be deployed probably until into the next century. There have already been cutbacks. Wouldn't the thing to do to send a signal to the American people would be to reduce the long-range missiles in the meantime? There have already been delays and questions raised in the United States about the wisdom of the Strategic Defense Initiative. It seems to me that you could move that debate along much more rapidly by agreeing to reduce the long-range missiles in the meantime and still have time to respond if you needed to.
Yes, provided that the ABM treaty is intact. Now on Afghanistan. This is our neighbor country. Given all the regimes, we were always good neighbors.
It is
a state which was one of the first to recognize Soviet power in Russia. There were kings and something quite different. They had their own processes underway.
And,
but whatever happened there, we were always friends. In fact, that's the way we try to build up relations with all of our neighbors. After the well-known revolution in Afghanistan, where an attempt was made to make some internal reforms and to bring that society out of its ancient system, but that was a purely domestic process. So a different government came to power, but at the same time, certain processes were building up, connected with, first and foremost, interference from outside in order to undermine that new regime. And they appealed to us as to their neighbors. Some say 11 times, others say 13 times. They appealed to us for help in that very difficult period. And at one of these very acute moments, when the situation really grew very exacerbated, we met the request of the Afghan government, and that does not run counter to the United Nations Charter. And we did, meeting their desire, we introduced our limited Soviet contingent of troops, and we have never increased it. But we see that today the situation does require some solutions. We are looking for ways to bring about a prompt solution of that problem. And I believe that if the American administration really does sincerely want that problem to be resolved, to be closed by political means, it could be done very quickly.
What is very quickly? Within 3 months? 6 months?
I think we can talk with the president about that.
Will that be high on your agenda in Washington next week, the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan and the guarantee that the government there will not be a threat to the Soviet Union?
I guess we will talk about regional conflicts in Central America, in Southern Africa, in the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and in Afghanistan.
Are you prepared to support Cuba and Nicaragua at the same level that you have been in the past, Mr. General Secretary?
Well, we must not only support and maintain the relations that we have with those states, we must develop and improve those relations.
But I
know that you meant something quite different when you were asking that question.
More arms, more advisors to Cuba and to Nicaragua.
Well, I think that there's more talk about that in order to
сохранять напряженность.
Keep up the tensions and maintain the tensions in that area. And the excuses for intervention. I have to smile when I hear that the security of the United States is being threatened by the Sandinista regime.
Это не серьезно.
That's not serious.
Это не серьезно.
It certainly is not serious.
Это задворки Латинской Америки.
This is the backyard of Latin America.
Где уже жить народ не мог.
Where the people just couldn't live
не
the way
it did. It couldn't,
it couldn't stand that dictatorship anymore, and it rose up against it.
Мы считаем морально.
And we feel that we were convinced that.
Правым все те, кто поддержал
справедливый гнев народа, who supported that indignation, the just indignation of that people, and took power into their own hands. Why shouldn't this suit the administration of the United States? I think now, even in Congress, they have understood that.
По-моему, в Америке понимают хорошо, что Никарагуа не угрожает.
Surely the Americans understand that Nicaragua cannot threaten, pose a threat to the United States.
But under new thinking, as you have defined it, wouldn't it be time to reduce the military assistance to places like Nicaragua and Cuba, and let those regimes begin to stand on their own?
Well, since you keep talking about the new thinking, then let me teach you a little lesson.
You're the teacher in new thinking.
I'm sure you will have no complaints as to about what I'm going to say.
Я думаю, ситуация сейчас
I believe the situation in the world is such that it differs fundamentally from what it used to be 30 or 40 years ago.
Уже не говоря,
not to mention, let's say, 50 or 70 years ago.
Империи ушли.
The empires have all gone. There are no more.
Десятки народов вышли.
Scores of nations have come out and begun their and are now developing independently.
Более того, эти все народы.
And moreover, all of those nations want not only political independence and autonomy, but they want to live a better life. They want to live like human beings.
Они нуждаются в продовольствии.
They need food. They need clothing. They need medicines.
И представьте себе.
And now just try and imagine 2.5 billion people in Asia. In Latin America,
располагают огромными природными ресурсами.
Dispose of vast natural resources.
Огромные трудовые ресурсы.
Vast manpower resources. And yet they are in debt. They have a very low standard of living.
Возникает вопрос.
So then the question arises.
Можно ли эту ситуацию оставлять без?
Can this situation be left without attention? It calls out for a solution.
Or
the ecology, is that not a global problem?
А борьба с болезнями, это разве не?
A struggle against disease, is that not a common problem?
А как?
What about
овладеть научно-технической революцией?
Mastering the scientific and technological revolution. Can we resolve all the problems there without cooperation? Is that not a global problem?
Если есть интересы у Советского Союза.
If the Soviet Union has an interest, the United States has an interest.
Есть интересы у других стран.
And so I guess the other countries and peoples also take an interest in these matters.
Если раньше международные
Previously, international relations were built upon the right of the strong.
Кто сильнее, тот и прав.
According to the maxim, right is might, that won't work today.
Мы не можем.
It's not appropriate.
С вами, как бы мы не были
we
сильны,
cannot, however strong we might be, we cannot dictate our values or impose our way of life upon others, impose on others our
дело.
Choice. It is up to them to decide. Unless we recognize the right to a choice and recognize the interests of every nation, nothing will come of international relations. And those relations are today fraught with serious explosions. So that means that a new thinking presumes the need to respect the choice of every nation. And we not only respect that choice, we try morally and where we believe it possible, economically and militarily, in the defensively, to support that choice, so that the nation, the people can defend what it has taken into its own hands. So there, that's where you have to really, by dint of joint effort, you have to get to the bottom of things and you have to change your approach. You cannot order the world around. Nothing will come of that. One, you have to change your approach.
You know how important symbols are in politics, Mr. General Secretary. There is no uglier symbol in the world of the division between East and West, of the division between your country and what the West stands for, than the Berlin Wall. Why don't you use your considerable influence with the East Germans just to have them take it down? What purpose does it serve anymore?
You know, I think that's a very clear question. That is the sovereign right of a sovereign state, the German Democratic Republic, to defend its and protect its choice and not to allow any interference in its domestic affairs. Through West Berlin, a lot was done which caused great harm, both political and economic, to that country, to that people. So these are all the realities which arose out of concrete situations. I can say to you, as I said once to a West German, he said to me, now, Mr. Gorbachev, Stalin used to say that Hitler's come and go, but the German people, the German state remain. But you have divided Germany into two states. So then I said to him, well, all right, let's remember facts of history. And I reminded him of those facts. He turned out that he knew them all, but it also turned out that division of Germany ran counter to the agreements reached in Yalta and Potsdam. So, the wall appeared before you think it did. It's another matter that it was made out of a different material. But as a result, what happened was what we have right now, and today those are realities, and you have to treat realities as they require.
Well, I don't think that we're going to lower the wall here this evening, but maybe we can do something about human rights. How can you persuade the world that there is new thinking and a new sensitivity on the part of the Soviet Union if you simply do not let the people who live in this country come and go as they please without risking their citizenship?
Mr. Brokaw, you will not be offended if I am forthright and say that I assume that I have a very educated man sitting across from the table from me and a very well-informed one. But now when we come to the so important a topic, you take only its speculative aspect. I'm ready to talk about human rights with any representative of the United States. With you too, naturally, if you're ready. And I can show you how things go in terms of human rights in this country and in your country and in other parts of the world. We are in favor of rights. In favor of the broad rights of the citizens. We're so dedicated to this that in fact was the purpose behind our revolution. And you know what we did during the revolution? We took away the power from the landowners and the Tsar. That right we gave back to the people. We took away the factories, the plants, and private property, and we gave them to the people, the working people. And it was on that basis that we eliminated the exploitation of man by man. We built up a planned economy. We guaranteed for each individual the right to work. We have no unemployed. And for how many years? For 50-odd years we have no unemployed. There's free education. And that is guaranteed by the state. Free medical care. The state, the society guarantees it, and the state largely has taken upon itself care for the provision of homes to the working people. Now, then why? And this is interesting. Now, by its level of national income, this country is lower than the per capita income. It is lower than the United States. But in terms of social protectedness, our society is much higher than yours. And now look, you were, what year were you born in?
I was born in 1940, Mr. General Secretary, but I know that you know what I'm talking about.
Just a moment, just a moment. Just a moment, let me tell you this. I will come to that. So, in 1944, Franklin Delano Roosevelt introduced his bill of social and economic rights, believing that there cannot be any real rights unless these problems are resolved. That was a very interesting bill, but it has remained in the congressional archives from that day on. Now, considering the fact that America is being criticized for not recognizing social and economic rights, that it is not signing or ratifying international covenants relating to that subject, the United States is being criticized for that throughout the world. And Mr. Reagan, this last July, Mr. Reagan introduced once again another version of that bill of social and economic rights. Although it was very different from the one that Roosevelt had, but yet, I think there'll be a lot of water passing through the Mississippi and the Volga before the U.S. Congress and the administration recognize the American people's right to their protection of their social and economic rights. But all that has been guaranteed in the Soviet Union. As regards the question that you have touched upon, that is exit, entry, you know, well, I understand the concern of the American side to some extent, since that is a nation, a people that was formed as a result, largely as a result of immigration processes. And therefore, our views are different. But, you know, as is the case in the United States or in Canada, they don't really want to allow into the United States people from Mexico or from other countries. Those who don't have the skills that are required. But as soon as in the 1970s, there was an especially big flow of those who wanted to emigrate from the Soviet Union. There was one highly placed representative of the administration who declared that we've resolved the problem of mathematicians by 50%. United States wants here too, through these channels, making themselves out to be an active defender of the rights of human rights to resolve their own problems, and what they're organizing is a brain drain. And of course we're protecting ourselves. That's number one. Then, secondly, we will never accept a condition when people are being exhorted from outside to leave their country. Now, thirdly, and all these cases will become more and more clear. Thirdly, and finally, all the specific individual cases are, we consider them in a very attentive and thorough manner, and this is very well known by the Congress and by the President. And we will continue in a spirit of humaneness, seek to resolve every individual case, but within the framework of our own laws. And so, therefore, you should not try and go into another man's monastery with your own charter. We have our state, we have our nation, a democratic state, which is based on the Constitution and our own laws. As for our goodwill, it is there. family reunification. We believe that to be a problem, and we shall do our best as to have those problems resolved. There may be other problems connected with immigration. We shall always be very attentive in considering them. But let us not inject any political speculation into this problem.
Do you think that the law moves too slowly in this country? What do you believe personally? What about those 4,000 Soviet Jews whose visas have been delayed for a long time? Some of them are cancer victims who want to leave the Soviet Union so they can be with their families in the closing days. What do you think about them, just man to man?
I think that right now we have, among those who have not been allowed to receive permission, only those who cannot leave because of state security reasons. There are no other reasons, and we will continue to act in that way.
Mr. General Secretary, I want to ask you something about perestroika and the reorganization of your economy. There's no greater need in the Soviet Union than in reorganizing how you produce food in this country. This great power has to import food. 2% of your farms produce 2/3 of the fruit and 1/3 of the milk and meat. Those 2% are the private plots. Are you going to greatly expand the private holdings of farmland and put it more on an incentive basis?
This question is one that was posed by President Reagan. I guess he may have asked you to ask me that question too.
No, this information is widely available in America to presidents and humble reporters alike.
Well, you know, let me say this. The food problem is one that does exist in this country, and although we eat 3,300 calories per person per day, so it's the question is one of the structure of the food intake. Now, as to the fact that 2% of the individual small holdings produce 1/3 of the output. Those 2% of the individual households could not have done a thing. For one reason. They get their grain, their animals, technical assistance, expert consultations, transport services,
семена,
their seeds from the collective and state farms. They are really integrated with the collective and state farms. There is the practice of contracts. They sign contracts. A collective farm, let's say, and an individual holding. Usually they are members of a state farm or a collective farm. And they participate in the process of increasing agricultural production.
So are you going to expand them?
In all of this, there is one very interesting aspect. We are right now on a long-term basis, we're offering families and groups of people that they take a plot of land or, let's say, hire some means of production, machinery, and show what their initiative is worth. And we have been able to combine the possibilities, the capacities of the large-scale farms and the individual interests of these small groups. Now, that is one thing, that is an area where we will lend further support to, and already this is yielding good results, and we shall be supporting this. But this does not mean that we're rescinding the collective farm system. No, this is a flexible combination of the possibilities for the large-scale farms, which assumes a great deal upon its own shoulders. And at the same time, the initiative, the interests, the personal and material interests of a family or of a small group of persons. That is to grow a certain crop or to produce a certain amount of farm animals.
Are you going to allow individual enterprises to set prices? Are you going to allow unemployment to rise in this country? Are you going to run the risk of recession and inflation as part of perestroika? That would be a fundamental overturning of the Soviet way of having an economy.
No, we will resolve this within the framework of socialism and through our own methods.
What?
Now, if in the West the structural policy and modernization which accompanies it is carried out or is accompanied rather by a growing unemployment, we want to avoid this, and this will be done in that very way. This opens up opportunities. Such opportunities are opened up by a planned system of economy. Already now we are elaborating our plans for organizing new jobs in new territories and in other spheres, especially in the sphere of services and trade. And therefore, on a planned basis, we will transfer some people with due assistance from the state, assistance needed to retrain people and sort of remove them from one sphere to another. And I believe that this will be done in such a way as not to affect the incomes of the working people. In other words, this adaptation of the economy to scientific and technological progress will be achieved within the framework of socialist approaches so as not to allow any unemployment. That is our pivotal task.
And no other party besides the Communist Party in the foreseeable future for the Soviet Union?
I see no need for any other party, and I think that is the view of our society. And today's changes, which are taking place, and deep-going changes, embracing the economy, politics, the sphere of democracy, the spiritual sphere, the social sphere, all this is taking place on the initiative of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. We have built up a new atmosphere in the country, an atmosphere of glasnost, openness. Firmly and consistently, we will follow the path of democracy and reforms firmly and consistently, but we will not jump over phases. We will not allow any adventurism. We have studied well the experience of all other countries in that respect, and our own experience too. But we will not allow conservatism to be rampant either. And we shall wage our struggle without allowing either adventurism and at the same time resolutely combating conservatism. And we shall be very thorough, very careful. There is a huge country behind us, a great people. We cannot allow playing with politics, politicking. And what happened with Yeltsin, well, look, this, in fact, it's a normal process for any democracy. I don't want to count how many ministers or secretaries were replaced recently in the United States in President Reagan's administration.
Yes, but when they're replaced, they get to speak out about why they were replaced. We get to hear from them.
You know, by the way, Comrade Yeltsin, both at the plenary meeting of the Central Committee, spoke twice, and he spoke at the plenary meeting of the City Party Committee. His speech at the plenary at the City Party Committee was published verbatim. Yeltsin himself posed the question of him being relieved from his post. He raised that question. So please trust us to resolve that question. I'm sure there will be other problems in Perestroika. They will have to be resolved. But let me assure you that we will continue our line aimed at Perestroika. We will be insistent in pursuing that line.
We have only a few moments left. I'd like to get to know more about Mikhail Gorbachev, the man. You wrote recently that there is a heated debate in this country about how to make it possible for women to return to a purely womanly mission. What does that mean? Do you think that women should be spending more time at home in the traditional role of mother and housemaker?
No, I think that a woman should take part in all spheres of life, in all of the processes taking place in society, but this must be done in such a way that the one should not prejudice the other, and all the more so we should think about how to help our women combine active participation in social, cultural processes with their duties, with their predestination. That is, as keeper of the home fires, of the family, guardian of the family, a strong family means a strong society. So we will not restrict the participation of women in public affairs. We will rather help women so that it is easier for a woman to combine the functions of motherhood, the role of the mother, and the role of an active citizen of the country.
We've all noticed the conspicuous presence of Mrs. Gorbachev in your travels. Do you go home in the evening and discuss with her national policies, political difficulties, and so on in this country?
We discuss everything,
including Soviet affairs at the highest level.
I think I have answered your question in toto. We discuss everything.
Where do you learn about the United States? Do you read American newspapers? Do you watch television programs? Do you have special people who tell you about what is happening in the United States? How do you satisfy your own curiosity about our country?
I have a lot of information that I have access to, not only on the basis of the press, but also through other channels. We have many translations of political, sovietological, artistic literature from the United States. So in this country, anyone who is interested in the United States has a great many possibilities to get to know America.
Do you have favorite American books, for example, that you've read in the past? Authors?
Well, I have to say that, of course, in my reading, pride of place belongs to Russian and Soviet literature, but American literature is certainly enjoys great interest, great popularity in this country. If we were to start trying to compare the number of authors that are read, Russian, Soviet authors and American American authors in this country, the figures would be enormous. Mostly I've read American classics, but I know some of the modern writers too, and they're very, very important writers. Only let the Americans not consider their achievements to be the truth in the last instance, in the uppermost degree, on anything. And if then they will find amongst us many people who would like to discuss a lot of problems, to exchange views and discuss a lot of problems with them.
Do you follow the 1988 presidential campaign in America closely? And if you do, who do you think will win next fall? That's a question that all Americans are asking themselves.
You know, we proceed from the assumption that we will be working constructively with any administration, regardless of party affiliation, whether Republican or Democratic, or another party, perhaps. We will cooperate if, provided there is the appropriate desire and effort on the other side. As for the election campaign, well, I just want to say that even after the campaign, we will be prepared actively and prepared to cooperate with whoever becomes the successor to the present president. As for forecasts about who will win and who will become the next president, I think that's an irresponsible task, an irresponsible exercise. The Americans will come to the conclusion of who they need best, and they'll do it themselves.
Finally, Mr. General Secretary, very briefly, how do you want to be remembered by Americans 10 years from now about the Gorbachev era?
Well, I don't want that in 10 years' time, everything should become belong to only the memory. I think by that time, there will only be a real upsurge in what we have begun to develop today. So I hope and believe that this will not simply be something belonging to the old past, it'll be a part of the dynamic present. And it is for the sake of that goal that together with my colleagues, together with our working people, that I am today, that today we are all of us seeking to do a lot, as much as we can. I think that today we are sowing some good seeds, and they will yield, they will give off a good yield in terms of results. If that were not so, it would be senseless to do what we're trying to do right now, and doing so with enthusiasm, intensively, with a great desire to change everything for the better in the interests of socialism, in the interests of the Soviet people. And I believe that what is now happening in this country will be a certain contribution to the progress of human civilization.
Mr. General Secretary, thank you very much for this time.
And once again, let me avail myself of this opportunity to say to my American viewers, until we meet on American soil.
A Conversation with Mikhail S. Gorbachev has been a presentation of NBC News.